You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. After 19 years, Rochelle Riley has turned in her final column for the Detroit Free Press. She took a buyout from the paper, and that final column appeared in yesterday's Free Press. But she won't be idle for long. Later this month, Rochelle becomes the City of Detroit's Director of Arts and Culture. Rochelle Riley, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I tell you, you have come here directly from the homegoing celebration for Judge Damon Keith. We are definitely going to be talking about that. But first, let's talk about you. Why was it time to say goodbye to the Free Press?
You know, when I came to the Free Press, it was back in 2000. My first day was on 9/11 of 2000. And I had been at the Courier-Journal in Louisville, Kentucky for 8 years. And I woke up one morning and said, I'm here. I have this great job. If I don't think about what I want to do next, I will look up in 10 years and I will still be here. So I got a call from Detroit saying, we'd like you to come here and do what you're doing there. Bigger market, growing city that needed more growth. And I asked my 11-year-old daughter, I said, you know, they want me to come and write my column in Detroit. She said, we should go. I've done everything there is to do here.
Well, 11-year-old. There you go. You got that vote. That's an important vote.
So it was parallel. I literally got inducted into the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame in 2016, which usually happens at the end of someone's career. But I still had lots to say and I was still writing. But I thought, if you're going to do something else, this is the time to start thinking about doing it. And opportunity met timeliness.
And the buyout offer came and you decided it was time.
I decided it was time.
You know, I'm wondering, when you think about coming to Detroit, and I know you're from North Carolina, had you been to Michigan before coming here? Or was this just a kind of a leap of faith? Let's go to Michigan.
My first visit to Detroit came probably about 12 years before I came here, because Bob Magruder, just the best editor the Detroit Free Press ever had in my lifetime. There might have been some guys before. I've heard some great stories about them. But he had tried to recruit me to come to Detroit twice before. And I came and I took one look at the city and I said, no, I just don't think so. Every place I was living just seemed to be a happier place, you know, not McDonald's happy, but it just seemed like there was a lot of work to do. But the third time was the charm, because I got to see potential and I got to see what I might be able to do because of the type of crusading I had been doing in Louisville. And I said, maybe I can help here.
Well, when I think about the fact when you came to Michigan, that 9/11 of 2000, John Engler was governor, mm-hmm. Dennis Archer was Detroit's mayor. And I dare say no one would have imagined Detroit would make history by plunging into bankruptcy just those few years later. What were your impressions once you kind of landed in Detroit and in Michigan? You became a Michigander. What did it look like to your fresh eyes?
Well, the first thing I did was told them I wouldn't write a column for a month because I needed to get to know the city and the area. And I drove around that ring around Detroit. And I called in every day just to talk to my editor about what I was doing. He said, what are you noticing? I said, I see white people. I said, what's the deal with this segregation? I'm in this city that at that point was almost 75%. No, actually, it was about 87% when I first got here, 85% black. And this ring around it was mostly white. And I would stop by city managers' offices and pick up maps and talk to people. And I got this strange sense that it was very segregated. And that was true then. And it's sort of true now. And now we've got a reverse segregation starting, where all of these folks are coming into the city. And I love it. And we're growing. But it's almost as if doing that was not quite the right way to do it.
All right. And I do want to get into kind of the thoughts about where we are today. When you came in, what was your own goal for your job as Free Press columnist? Not what they said, but what was your goal?
Oh, I knew what I was going to be doing. Same thing I did in Louisville, crusading. I was going to fight for children, fight for art, fight for community, point out wrongs, and keep government accountable, which is why I had no problem writing about people who thought they were powerful until you questioned them. Mm. So I covered four mayors, and I had things to say about all of them. And people used to tell me, Rochelle, you're going to get in some trouble. And I went, oh, I hope so. I hope so.
Because?
Because my job was to disturb the peace. And if things were not going the way they should go, it was my job to point that out. It was my job to say something about it.
What are the stories, some of the stories or people that you've covered that changed you?
There were three. Well, actually four. My debut column called for the Detroit Public Schools to be shut down. And people thought, who the heck is this woman? That let me know that that was something that needed attention, because all of a sudden I had parents calling asking me about bond money that had been approved and not been spent, about children not being able to read. And I said, where have you all been while all of this was going on? So that became this lifelong or this 20-year mission to write about schools. The second thing was when I started writing about literacy and about adults that couldn't read, and people called me up and they didn't say that's not true. They said, please don't tell people, because they knew it. People have known about this for some time, and it dawned on me, well, of course they know. Right now, only 10% of the third graders in the Detroit Public Schools Community District read at grade level. What do we think happens to those kids when they grow up? They're the adults who are functionally illiterate and just need help reading. There's nothing wrong with them. It's not that they're not smart. Mm-hmm. It's that they just didn't learn. So that was the second one. The third one was writing about Damon Keith through the years, because Judge Keith was literally one of the most iconic civil rights leaders of all times anywhere in the country. And to live at a time of Damon Keith's time in this city was great. And the fourth was the rape kits and working with Kim Worthy to make sure those kits got tested.
And that did.
Yes, Detroit did.
Really did set, because it's a problem in other cities
that has not
been addressed the same way. What are the stories that you're sorry you won't be writing about for the Free Press? There's a lot of pots bubbling away right now. What are you sorry you're not going to get a chance to write about?
There are dozens of them. At the top of the list is fixing the schools. I do have one more project that's going to appear in the Free Press. I won the Pulliam Prize, and if they give you $75,000, you can do what you want. I was going to go live 6 months in Fiji. And I thought, no, that's not the right thing to do. So I studied the effect of trauma and toxic environments on how children learn. And I am proud to say that Wayne State University Press has agreed to give me a contract for that book. It'll be my third.
Very good.
Thank you.
And it is work that actually matters throughout Michigan. We've got a lot of traumatized children, and that's something we've explored here on this show. So when that book comes out, we'll have to talk about
that
book.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to talk about newspapering.
Okay.
Now, when did you begin in the newspaper business?
1981.
I was
a recent graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Journalism.
So give us a sense of how newspapering has changed through your career in that business.
Newspapers were then and are now run mostly by white men who truly, because many of them are good at what they do, there's a sense of arrogance that makes them not think ahead. It's like, things are going great. This is the way we do things. This is the way we're supposed to do things. Well, by God, we're going to keep up with that, which means so many things passed us by. We were literally the inventors of classified ads, and we let Craigslist take that over. We literally could have used the web to give people news for subscriptions, just like we should have. Instead, we let other people do it first, and then we put it on our websites for free, and now we want people to pay for it. It's like we've been reacting to things, because that's sort of what news used to be. Something would happen, and we'd chase it. You can't win by chasing. So now we have to start thinking more strategically and give people the things that they really want, even before they know they want it.
But now there are people that it's not a habit to pick up a newspaper. They're used to looking on their Twitter feed and cherry picking stories here and there. How do we train, or how do you see newspapers training readers to rely on them?
We have to stop giving them what they can find on Twitter and Facebook. That means those time-told tales that only certain people can write, the obituary that you won't find on Twitter because it can't be told in 240 characters, investigative pieces that really, rock the boat. You know, the Detroit Free Press has been on guard for years. The investigations that we do, and other papers do, that's not a Facebook story. But what you've got to do is promote and train people to know that that is the only place you can get it.
And people who don't know what's been going on behind the scenes may not realize how the staff has contracted. So you've got a lot of people who are stretched really thin.
It's been decimated. If we don't hurry up, now see, I don't call it the Riley plan like the Marshall plan, but if they don't start doing those types of things, we're going to will ourselves out of existence by trying to compete with Twitter and online news services instead of doing what they can't do. The Detroit Free Press was once 300 strong, and I'm not allowed to say, and actually I don't even know, but I know we're below 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're working with a third of the people, but people still expect the same type of coverage, that's a dilemma.
It's a dilemma. I'm speaking with Rochelle Riley. After 19 years at the Detroit Free Press, her final column appeared in yesterday's paper. And now on to your next chapter. On May 27th, you will become the City of Detroit's Director of Arts and Culture. Now, is this a newly created position?
It is indeed. We are, and I've said this a couple of times so people will get used to it, we don't have a creative corridor in Detroit. We are a creative corridor. We are an entire industry of arts, culture, and entertainment. And so what we need to do is embrace that. There's so much that's already happening there that we don't celebrate, but there's so much more that can happen that we can do. And my job is to first get people excited about what we already do and market it to the world. And second is to make sure we're doing all of that new stuff that Detroit is primed for. We have the best designers. Edsel Ford brought art design to cars. We have people who turn the sides of buildings into museums. We have the best dancers. We have singers. We have spoken word artists who are nationally known, and we just sort of, you know, let them go off and do their stuff instead of letting people know that they're homegrown, they're Detroit born, they belong to us.
Well, and I know you have not started on this job yet, and you've just published your final Free Press column, but I'm sure you've spent thinking about, you know, the ways that you want to tackle this new mission. What do you think the biggest challenges are going to be for you?
Well, with everything, you're competing for people's attention and competing for their dollars. If you're going to convince people that something is worth spending money on, you got to really make the case that it's worth spending money on. And that's my job. As the mayor said, I'm going to lead efforts to attract additional funding and talent to help build on Detroit's vibrant arts, cultural, and creative. Well, here's the thing.
Yeah. What's that mean?
That should be an easy job if you tell people what it is. So my job is to tell people what it is. And I've been telling people what it is for 19 years. So I think I can try and do that.
Who is the market? Who are you talking to with this? Are you talking to the rest of Michigan? Are you talking to the country, the world?
I have three markets. There's the internal market of artists who need to know and celebrate each other. There's that whole Detroit market so that people who are in the city support what's in the city because we want to help raise up what we've got. And then there's everybody else, Michigan, the nation, and the world. We have people who come from around the world to the little Hittsville, USA Museum. And we have never really made a big deal out of that. And we should. That expansion should have already happened because there is no place else in the world that that exists.
Oh, you're right about that. Are you going to have a staff? Are you got funding? What's the money situation?
I will have a staff, and I will be having meetings with the city now about what I think that staff should look like. And I have been losing sleep working on it every night, trying to find just the right small team of people to make it work.
That term, arts and culture, is so broad. It's so general. What does it mean to you?
I think it's broad on purpose so we can define just what we want our, you know, space to be and what we want to accomplish. My big thing is to bite off something and then chew it really great and then make it into something special. So if you try to too narrowly define what you're going to do at the very beginning, I don't think that helps. I want my team to help determine that. I want the residents of Detroit to help determine that. This is the City of Detroit's Office of Arts and Culture. They're going to help determine what that is because it could be anything.
And as you alluded to earlier, that we've had this kind of migration of, you know, you noticed the segregation when you came here.
Yes.
And now we're seeing this kind of movement where you're seeing especially younger, you know, white residents coming in and buildings are being, I mean, everywhere you look around downtown and midtown, things are happening.
Yes.
How do we see arts and culture bridging tensions between these new Detroiters and the longtime Black Detroiters who've been sticking it out in the neighborhoods?
Well, see, if you're building bridges, that still keeps separations. I don't want bridges. I want fabric that we're all working on because everybody who's a poet is a poet regardless of their color. Everybody who paints is a painter regardless of their color. Everybody who plays violin regardless of their culture, their race, their background. I want people to be connected by art. I want people to be connected by what they love. Then that way we don't build bridges. We're all on the same side. So we're all on this side of the river waving at people who are at that river that separates us from the rest of the country saying, come on to Detroit.
When you stop and you think about all the ways people can be isolated and divided from who they voted to in the last presidential election to how easy it is to pour so much time and energy with noses stuck on smartphones or in tablets in that online life and not enough real person-to-person life, arts and culture can be a solution to that.
It's going to be the new home. When you go on Twitter, you can go over there and, you know, participate in all that stuff. Or you can come to a Trump-free zone, a hate-free zone, and talk about, you know, the latest wonderful show you saw or the latest film that you thought should be something that people in Detroit can see, or quite frankly, what you're painting that day. I mean, I want us to talk to each other in a new language that speaks to what we all have in common, and that's that we love art, we have art, and we have some of the most wonderful artistic geniuses of all kinds right in our city.
And does this also provide a way to knit Detroit and the rest of Michigan together?
Absolutely. See, here's why the grand bargain, and for people who forget, that was the reason the bankruptcy succeeded, because everybody around the state said, okay, we're going to pitch in and make sure that our largest city doesn't fall. But you know why that happened? Because I talked to people all around the state. They're all from Detroit, or they have a connection to Detroit. I talked to people in the UP who were born in Detroit and moved up there. I talked to people in Traverse City who their parents still live here. And, you know, we have to remember that this is literally sort of the hub of Michigan. So as long as we all know we have that connection, we want to fight for the growth and the beauty of this place that's special.
Speaking of a fighter, tell us about Judge Damon Keith's homegoing celebration.
Oh,
what was said and who spoke?
Well, I can tell you three things. One is the most important remarks were given by his daughter, Cecile, who talked about him as a man and how with all of the things he was doing and with the five landmark decisions that he rendered that changed the face of civil rights, he still spent Saturdays with his girls, going for hamburgers, going to take them to dance lessons, it was just a reminder that he was a consummate professional, but also one of the best human beings. So while several people talked about the history and the governor talked about this legion of people that he trained, his former law clerks who became governors and top attorneys, and a journalist who he always, you know, he was fuel for me, he was also one of the best men who ever lived.
What's his legacy to Michigan?
That we all have to be warriors. You know, even though I am now working in arts, culture, and entertainment, if you look to my Twitter page or look to my website, it says I am a writer by trade, a warrior by necessity. No matter what else I'm doing, I'm still going to be fighting to make sure that our Constitution is intact and every child grows up to be the best American they can be.
And that's how he lived his life.
That's how he lived his life.
Rochelle Riley, newly retired Detroit Free Press columnist and newly appointed as the City of Detroit's Director of Arts and Culture. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.